the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells.
We have Zach Wienersmith with us. He's the cartoonist behind the popular geek web comic Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal. His work has been featured, in The Economist, The Wall Street Journal, Slate, Forbes, Science Friday, and on and on. His wife, Kelly, is a top scientist, and together they bring us a look at emerging technologies that sound far-fetched enough, but they're not, that Zach's cartoonist skills come into play as a means to have fun with science fiction. Wait, no, it's actual, science reality. From 3D organ printing to how to fling a spaceship into deep space on the cheap, it's a hilariously illustrated investigation into future technology. Zach Wienersmith, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you. Well, first of all, I have to say that, you know, your wife, Kelly, the top scientist, leaves you to do, you, the illustrator, and the cartoonist to do the interview on Cool Science Radio. How about that?
Well, I say in my defense, I did a decent amount of the research as well. But you know, it helps to have someone with the scientific bona fides and knowledge of how to do research properly to help me along.
Yes, well, I can imagine that the talk around your house must be very interesting. Tell me first, because I'm not familiar with Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal. What do you do with that webcomic?
Sure, it's a daily comic. It's a humor comic, and it's mostly targeting nerds. I just yesterday did a joke about complexity classes, which are an important thing in computer science, so it can be pretty thick, but there's also regular human people jokes, too, from time to time.
Zach, the intersection of computer science and molecular biology is one of the most exciting areas in technology today. And you talk about synthetic biology. Can we talk about that a little bit? Because it's just fascinating.
Sure. I mean, so as a way to think about it, it would be really neato if you could come across an organism that just happened to make gasoline from, you know, atmospheric carbon dioxide, right? But you know, evolution tells us there's no reason for it to do that. It doesn't know what humans want, and even if it did, it probably wouldn't just start doing it. And even if it wanted to, so to speak, that's a pretty tall order. That's a lot of complicated molecules. So, you know, the idea is in each of these organisms, these simple microbes, there's this library of DNA. And now we have very recently developed technology that allows us to fiddle with it in an accurate way without spending an enormous amount of money. It's still fairly expensive, but it's getting cheaper all the time. So the idea is you could sort of make life to order to do stuff like make a fuel or medicine, et cetera. There's other stuff, too. You could potentially make life that acts as a sort of little memory bank for detecting stuff. So, you know, DNA is the library of the cell, so to speak. It's a bit more, you know, one should be careful with analogies, but something like that is true. And so a library can store information so you can, in principle, make cells that travel through the body and take in information and store it in a way that we can access later, which, you know, obviously has potentially amazing medical implications.
And you asked the rhetorical question, which I love. Why stop at 7 margaritas when you can just print a new liver?
Yes. That's in our section on bioprinting. I should hasten to add, we actually asked people, you know, about that question. Could you drink 7 margaritas a day if we could print new livers? And the response was, you know, even if you could print a new liver, it just turns out liver transplant surgery isn't like a piece of cake. So you should probably still ease up, even if there is a future of bioprinted organs.
You know, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, people like that, space is their plaything, trying to figure out ways to colonize Mars and all kinds of things like that. But the bottom line is their money, their supply of money is not endless. It's finite and it's expensive to go into space. And you look at some of the ways that you see cheap access to space, and it's really hard to believe that people are actually talking about this.
Yeah. We try to structure it to go from plausible to crazy. So the fundamental reason we don't have a Mars settlement is not really technology. If we launched, like if the U.S. government tomorrow said we're putting $1 trillion a year into building a Mars settlement, it could be done. It would not have to use any substantially new technology, nothing we don't know how to do. problem is it would be incredibly expensive. Really, the fundamental thing holding us back with space is the cost. Roughly speaking, it costs $10,000 a pound to put stuff into space. And actually, if you want to go to Mars, it costs a lot more. And the reason that's true is because most rocket launches go like this. You have this skyscraper-sized tube, 80% of which is propellant, 80%. Four-fifths of the vehicle is stuff you burn up on the way up. And then the vehicle itself is about 16.5% to 17% just the vehicle, right? So you're down to 3%, which is what is stuff that actually goes to space. And it's actually worse than that. If you're going to the moon, it gets closer to 1.5%, or at least that was true on the Apollo mission.
Wow.
And so as an analogy, the way we like to say it is it's like if imagine you wanted to go to Hawaii, but the only way to do it was get the 737, fly over Hawaii, jump out of the parachute, and then, you know, watch the 737 explode.
Yeah.
You would be very expensive. You wouldn't want to check that extra bag because it'd be $4 million or something. But so that's essentially what we do in spaceflight right now. So the idea is could you route around that by some means?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting metaphor. If you look at it that way, people would say, no, we ought never to go to space. But in the book, Soonish, you have some cartoons and some illustration of what that might look like. And it's this long ribbon-like cable attached to a rock. Can you elaborate?
Sure. So without getting too dorky about the physics, you know, essentially you want something in space where its center of mass is in geosynchronous orbit. And all that means, if you imagine a sort of string that runs out from the surface of a ball, if the ball is spinning faster than the string is spinning with it, the string will wrap around. Well, if you're trying to go to space by climbing that string, which is the idea of a space elevator, it would be really embarrassing if the string started to wrap around Earth. So the reason you need that counterweight is because the tether itself weighs quite a bit. It doesn't weigh that much, you know, per foot, let's say, but it weighs a lot overall because it's enormous. It's 100,000 kilometers long, about 60,000 miles. So the purpose of the weight on the outer end is to keep the center of mass at the right place. As a sort of loose physics analogy, if you imagine you have a spring with a rock on it and you start spinning it, it's a little easier to keep the spring where you want it to be if you've got that rock on the end. I think that's a bit more intuitive. The other cool thing is, of course, the thing on the end might be a captured asteroid or a space base or something nifty. So maybe there's a hotel up there you can stay in when you're at the end of the space elevator.
Hey, if you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Zach Wienersmith. The book that he has co-written and illustrated with his wife, Kelly, is Soonish, 10 Emerging Technologies That Will Improve and or Ruin Everything. Zach, I wanted to ask you, why is it so hard to predict the future?
Right. So we say the real problem is the future is very contingent. It depends on lots of different interfacing factors. So the example we give at the beginning of the book is this story about superconductors and ultimately about how to read minds. But it starts with Michael Faraday having to make his own glassware and discovering that under high pressure, all gases turn to liquid. And, you know, you have to imagine if you go back to the 19th century, this is kind of miraculous. The idea that you could take air and turn it into a liquid, that seems, you know, like fairy stuff. But it's a thing that can be done, of course. And it turns out the best way to do it is to supercool liquids. If you remember from high school chemistry, if you cool them down, they start interacting with each other more, and then you get a liquid. And there's this race in Victorian science to be the first to, like, liquefy hot helium, hydrogen, et cetera. And a byproduct of that is we learn how to supercool all sorts of things, right? So if you have this supercool hydrogen, you can pour it over anything else and supercool it. And that leads to the surprise discovery of what are called superconductors. And without going too much into that, it turns out with superconductors, you can make ultra-powerful magnets, which can be used for a modern device called a superconducting quantum interference device, or more colloquially, SQUID. And a SQUID can allow you to read brain signatures. And so the point is, if you're Michael Faraday looking at this glass tube with liquid gas in it, you certainly don't think, I wonder if we could read minds with this. It turns out the stuff that's easy to predict is kind of boring. It's very easy to predict. Computers will get better. Solar panels will get more efficient. Computers will get faster. I don't know. You know, there's a lot of basic, obvious stuff, but the interesting stuff is often surprising. And so we try not to predict because we don't think it's really possible.
What is out there that you feel pretty confident is going to happen, though? I mean, there's some things that are out there that you might think, well, I don't know about that, but it could happen. But you may have some confidence in some of these areas.
Absolutely. So the way to think about it is, well, the one, you can cheat because some of these are already extant in some primitive form, like augmented reality and synthetic biology, and some of the reusable space travel stuff is already happening, like at SpaceX. But additionally, it helps to think about, like, is there a market for incremental improvement? So, you know, people always cite computers as an example of something that gets better and better and better and cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, and isn't it amazing? Part of why that's the case is that we are all collectively willing to spend a bunch more money for tiny, tiny improvements in computer specs. All right, so the phones get better and better because you will pay a lot of money for 10% more battery life, like moderate improvement in the quality of batteries. But if you look at airplanes, your experience on an airplane is not wildly different from what it would have been in 1965. Like, there's better navigation technology, and that's important. There's all sorts of neat stuff, but it's evolutionary. You might even occasionally fly in an airplane that's still from that era. And the reason is there hasn't developed a market for slight increases in speed, and there's also a lot of cost involved in making those slight improvements. So as an example, from our book, with brain-computer interfaces, you can imagine a world where slight improvements in being able to take brain signals produces economic benefits, although, it, you know, there is the creep factor to that. But there is an economic incentive to do it, which makes it seem, at least to me, more plausible than some of these other ideas.
Yeah, so the line is really blurred between what the future will, how it will unfold, and things that, as you say, get caught in blind alleys. But it seems like every week I read about some new technology with 3D printing, or not a new technology, but some new application for 3D printing. You made a joke about 3D printing a liver, an organ, but where are you seeing 3D printing going? And I can't think of any examples right now, but I know you can.
Well, so we mostly focus on bioprinting of 3D stuff, which is one important area. As a general way to think about 3D printing, it's helpful to consider a couple different cases. So for one-off constructions, 3D printers are really nice, right? But for something like a toothbrush, it'll never be a good idea to 3D print a toothbrush. I think there were these ideas early on in 3D printing, like we're going to completely revolutionize industrial methods. It turns out we have completely revolutionized things like prototyping. And there are certain types of materials, like in airplane wings, if you want like a three-dimensional honeycomb texture, that's something that's very hard to do without something like a 3D printer. That's valuable. But for anything that's mass-produced and not very complicated, the technology is not going to come along. In terms of bioprinting, there's a lot of really cool stuff. We were just talking to a friend of ours, Jordan Miller, who is working on a way to make to replace part of lungs. And as you might imagine, lungs are quite complicated. He has these really cool methods where you can 3D print by having a polymer that absorbs energy and then hardens, and you do that in gel, which is nice because then you can get these 3D structures even when they're like weird shapes with overhangs and stuff, which would be really hard to do by just extruding material. So there are a lot of cool developments. I'm afraid I know a bit more about the bioprinting side than sort of general universe of 3D printing.
Well, it's pretty interesting if you think about the number of people all over the world and in our country who wait on lists for a match for a transplant, you know, whether it's kidney, mm-hmm. lung, whatever it is, you know, this might show really great promise.
Oh, absolutely. It goes beyond that. We talked to a guy named Gabor Forgoch at Organovo, and he actually said, you know, why stop at just replacing organs? Maybe we could do a little better than nature, which is a bit of an ominous possibility. And there's also, I don't know, there's something a little strange about having a copyrighted organ in your body. But who knows? I don't know. Maybe we could, up our athletic performance or somehow be safer against certain diseases. It remains to be seen.
We've done a number of shows on artificial intelligence, and I just get a kick out of this, you know, when I'm talking to my friends or maybe meeting some new people that have listened to the show. They always just go down to the same common denominator, and they say, when are the robots coming for our jobs, and when are they coming to kill me and my family? And I just get a kick out of that. But you had an interesting angle on some things that I hadn't considered before, that scientists are designing robots that can lay bricks and even 3D print houses while moving. And some of this is pretty interesting. I mean, I know they flip burgers, and I know that they do a number of other things, but I hadn't thought about the construction business.
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, my line on that, which I got from a friend, is you should be more scared of natural stupidity than artificial intelligence. That remains a major problem. But in the short term, there is some neat stuff happening. So one of the reasons you might want to do robotic construction is it's one of the few fields that's really not that automated, right? So if you look around your room or if you're in your car, most of what you're looking at was made with economies of scale in a factory. Now, buildings are made with prefab parts, of course, and that helps. But they still have to be done on site by skilled human beings who walk around the construction site building it. So the idea with robotic construction is by some means or other, there are a couple ways to do it. You could replace some of that labor with a computer because the assembly of a building is run by algorithms. So in principle, you should be able to tell a computer how to do it. It just turns out a lot of the little tasks that go into construction are quite difficult for a machine. There are a couple procedures to do it. And as you say, though, there's a scary aspect to this economically, which is, a large part of the U.S. labor force is in construction. And it also is one of the few remaining jobs where you don't need a college education to have a good middle-class job. And obviously, if robot construction reaches its ideal form, those jobs might go away or would go away. So we actually talked to some economists about what this means. And the basic deal is nobody knows. And, it depends. If you replace a bunch of people's jobs, potentially they should be able to get other jobs eventually. This is what happened with blacksmiths, what happened with, horse and buggy drivers, what happened with all the agricultural workers, who used to be most of our workforce. The problem is there are real problems for those people who lose their jobs in the medium term. Their lives may be irreparably harmed. And so that has to be dealt with both from an ethical standpoint and a political standpoint.
Yeah. Now, the book has 10 emerging technologies that will improve and, as you say, and or ruin everything. Getting to that 10 was probably not easy because you have one chapter that talks about some of the runner-ups. And one of the runner-ups that I thought would garner some attention would be quantum computing. Where are we with quantum computing? Because so much stuff is misstated and miswritten, and what's going on?
So a friend of mine liked to joke. We got a quantum computer to factor 15 into 5 and 3, and 21 is on the horizon. So quantum computers, let's say, are still in a very rudimentary state. There's now finally a lot of money being spent on it. People I know who were skeptical of it happening anytime soon now think, it's coming. The problem is, very simple forms of quantum computer generally aren't going to be much more useful than a regular old computer, right? But the time will come. I don't know. So I'll give you an example. You were talking about how the media will often misreport stuff about quantum computers. So if you watch something about quantum computing, one thing you'll often hear is it's going to break down cryptography. And what's going on there is that there is a computer algorithm called RSA. It was developed in the 70s that, without getting into the details, uses a particular kind of math. And with a quantum computer, you could break that math. You could solve the problems quickly, and you could hack in. But so in theory, that's scary because you can break all cryptography on which, having your private Gmail account depends. However, there are already algorithms that are, in theory, not vulnerable to quantum computers. The fundamentally cool thing about a quantum computer is that it's using the quantum nature of the universe to do computing. That is objectively awesome, and it almost doesn't matter if there are applications. It turns out there will eventually be applications like perhaps protein folding. That might be an early one that quantum computers could do a better job than classical computers. But that might be, 10, 20, 30, 40 years off.
Is it the performance of the quantum computer, or is it the ability to address much larger sets with the qubit versus the... yes or no?
Quantum computers generally often represented as sort of, quote unquote, the next step in computing. It's really a different type of computer that uses the weird quantum nature of qubits having to do with probability amplitudes to be able to solve certain types of problems, let me not get too much into the weeds on it, but like Jonathan Dowling had a wonderful book on this called Schrodinger's Killer App, and one way he explained it, and this is very, very loose way to think about it, but if you want to simulate an atom of thulium, thulium has a whole bunch of different particles in it doing complicated quantum-y stuff. It's extremely hard for a classical computer to do that computation. But, of course, if you have qubits, those qubits don't know that they are not molecules inside thulium. So potentially you could simulate what they're doing. And so part of why protein folding is complicated is because, you know, we thought a molecule was just these little billiard balls that kind of bump around in a classical way, and it turns out they do this weird quantum stuff. They do, it seems like they're doing, the universe is doing way more computation under the hood than it needs to. So it was Richard Feynman, I think, who first said, hey, what if we can sort of use that computation under the hood against the problem itself? And that's, in theory, what a quantum computer should be able to do. But I should say the reason we didn't do a chapter on it is because the actual non-Hain-Wavy version, like I'm giving you now, is far more complicated than we thought we could do in a book like this. I'm actually working on bits and pieces for a project on it, but we couldn't fit it in this book.
Mm. Zach Wienersmith is our guest. He's a cartoonist. His wife, Dr. Kelly Wienersmith, is adjunct faculty at Rice University in the Biosciences Department. They've co-written a book, Soonish, 10 Emerging Technologies That'll Improve
and or Ruin Everything. Zach, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you missed part of the show or you want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org under the Shows tab.
We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows wherever you find your podcasts, so you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name.
So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio and take us with you on your next road trip or commute.